Percy Mitchell.
Well, thank you very much. So this session, I'm looking forward very much to the discussion we're going to have, because of all the various models that we've been discussing, supersymmetry, at least colloquially, we think of it as being the most under attack by the LHC. And the most best way to protect against an attack is to mount a good defense. And the way to have a good defense is to have a good opinion. And my hope is to elicit strong opinions from those of you in the audience. And in fact, being asked to give this talk forced me to elicit strong opinions from myself. And I took to heart Michael's request that I have an opinion. And in some ways, this talk that I'm going to give is my attempt in my own brain to form an opinion about supersymmetry in 2013. And I'm going to definitely have a perspective that's coming from my own research, so I'll tell you a few things that are on my mind. But I'm going to start with a completely unreasonable wish list. When Michael first asked me to talk about this, thinking, what would I imagine that the frontiers could do? And just kind of remind you of the grand vision that we had for supersymmetry and the things that we hoped that we could measure at experiments. Then come back down to Earth with the status of supersymmetry in 2013. And then, this is where the opinion comes in, my own wish list for the frontiers, a way that I have tried to prioritize the aspects of supersymmetry that I think we should really study the most. And again, I was forced to have an opinion to come up with this list, and I want my mind to be changed. I want you to tell me why my list of things is completely wrong and why I should be actually much more interested in other things. So one disclaimer, again, I'm asked to have an opinion. The other disclaimer is that while I'm a physicist, recently I've been running a biology experiment. This is my six-month-old. He's at the Knowledge Frontier participating in an MIT brain science program. But what this means is that I haven't been engaged that much with the snowmass process. And so some of these things that I've talked about will be very familiar, I assume, to those of you participating in snowmass, but it's all new to me to kind of come up with ideas of what we can do in the future. Okay, so let me start with an unreasonable wish list. So I want to take the broad view. We've heard about different field contents possible in supersymmetry. We've heard about the MSSM and MSSM. We've heard about various different spectra that we can have, very interesting ideas about how we can modify, change, explore the spectrum of supersymmetry. In the background, there's always been this idea of simplified models, a way of parameterizing searches at the LHC in terms of just the quantum numbers of the states. But if I step back and ask, what do I really want to get? I don't particularly have a preference for any particular field content, any particular spectrum, any particular simplified model where I think Susie's going to show up. Ultimately, what I would like to have is I'd want to have a way of testing supersymmetry as a well-motivated extension of space-time symmetry. That's the kind of information that ideally I'd like to have. And ideally, I'd really like to use superpartners as probes of structural questions in SUSY. And it's not just discovering new particles. Ideally, you'd like to know whether the questions that underlied our excitement about SUSY, whether they're really realized in nature. So let me remind you about these structural questions. So let's assume we're among friends. Of course, supersymmetry is realized in nature. And if supersymmetry is realized in nature, then it's potentially relevant for understanding the holy trinity of questions beyond the Standard Model. So for this audience, I don't have to remind you about naturalness, unification, and dark matter. But I do want to point out that ideally, we'd like experimental, direct experimental probes of each of these three issues. In the case of naturalness, it's not sufficient to find just a partner particle of the various Standard Model fields. Ideally, you'd really want to test the coupling structure. And we heard, for example, from Matthew McCullough about ideas about precision Higgs physics as a way to begin to address this question about whether there's actually cancellations of divergences. In the case of unification, some would say already we proved that unification exists, at least in the running of the gauge couplings. But you'd want to even go deeper, looking for things like B-tau unification, unification of Giugino masses, tests of whether this unified picture of physics obtaining some kind of simplicity at high scales, whether that's really realized. And of course, in the context of dark matter, SUSY gives you any number of different dark matter candidates, ranging from gravitinos, axinos, neutralinos, hidden sector particles. And you'd like to understand, have direct experimental probes of whether any of those supersymmetric particles are responsible for some component of dark matter. Now, if we take this kind of motivation and go one layer deeper to something that model builders care a little bit more about in terms of structural questions, if supersymmetry is realized in nature, we'd really like to test experimentally whether supersymmetry is realized via the standard SUSY paradigm. We'd like to know whether it's really the case that we have a visible sector of fields that experiences supersymmetry breaking by some external dynamics. and mediated to us by some messenger fields. So of course, we'd love to be able to measure the spectrum of soft masses. We'd love to be able to take that spectrum of soft masses and somehow infer some information about the messenger sector, the quantum numbers of the mediators. And ideally, we'd like to understand what the scale of supersymmetry breaking is. Can we really test, well, in a real perfect world, is it metastable SUSY breaking versus not? Are all moduli stabilized supersymmetrically or not? Blah, blah, blah. But at minimum, understand what the ultimate scale of supersymmetry breaking is. And again, in my perfect world, want to get direct experimental probes of this. And if I finally go the kind of the very bottom of the basic structural questions of supersymmetry, you'd like to know whether supersymmetry is really a symmetry that obviously relates bosons and fermions, but is it really an extension of space-time symmetry? And if it's an extension of space-time symmetry, which space-time are we extending? And often we talk about, or at least we teach, that supersymmetry is an extension of the Poincaré symmetry. And that's really kind of technically not correct. Of course, I'm guilty of it. I gave lectures at the TASSI Summer School last summer, and of course, I talked about the flat space SUSY algebra. But strictly speaking, if you really want to get to the structural level, then if supersymmetry is realized in nature, then we're all going to have to learn about supersymmetry, not in flat space, but in anti-de Sitter space. Because our universe right now is approximately flat. But when you break supersymmetry, the cosmological constant always goes up. And so the underlying real symmetry of our universe is supersymmetry in anti-de Sitter space, broken to give a vacuum that's in flat space. And ideally, you'd want to test this as well. You want to have a direct experimental probe of this fine-tuning between a parameter, the gravitational mass, that actually preserves anti-de Sitter space supersymmetry, and the SUSY breaking dynamics that lifts you up to flat space. You want to test this fine-tuning. This is just the cosmological constant fine-tuning. And some work that I've been doing with Francesco D'Aramon and Zach Thomas, our realization that even this structure of supersymmetry as living in anti-de Sitter space, in principle, has some direct experimental testable probes. And in particular, what we call anomaly mediation turns out to not have anything to do with supersymmetry breaking. Rather, you can ask me offline, this is an effect that's perfectly supersymmetric, albeit in this alternate space-time that we don't occupy, supersymmetry in anti-de Sitter force space. So these are the kind of things that I want direct experimental probes on. And so when I first got the email from Michael, this is the list that I wished for that the frontiers could do, starting with finding all super partners of all standard model fields, verifying the cancellation of quadratic divergence in the Higgs sector, verify all the supersymmetric and unification coupling relations, verify this fine-tuning of ADS curvature against SUSY breaking, measure the gravitational mass. Of course, there's gravitational dark matter. Measure its abundance through direct detection experiments. Use this information to extract the messenger quantum numbers. Extract hidden sector dynamics. Test whether moduli are stabilized supersymmetrically. A bunch of other things that will, of course, give us all the information we need to determine which string vacuum we occupy. Now, yes, this is. Yeah. Now, this seems crazy, but it's not entirely pie in the sky. And just to remind you of some things, that actually we had a chance to answer these questions. And if I would want to express my frustration about not having seen superpartners thus far, it's because we were denied access to some of these interesting structural questions. And let me just give you an example of something where we actually could have learned something via direct experimental probes that could have answered at least some of this list. In particular, so Mihoko's familiar with this, it was possible to actually test this cancellation between SUSY breaking and ADS curvature if we happen to have been lucky enough that the lightest ordinary sector particle was a metastable charge particle. So in your brain, think about it as a slepton or a stau. And we could have been in a situation where we could have pair-produced these staus. These guys would have traveled through your detector. Through ionization energy loss, they would have lost energy and stopped. Then you could have waited for some amount of time and watched their decay to a lepton and a gravitino. And in this cascade decay from a slepton waiting a long time going down to a gravitino, you can actually, if you're in a kinematically favorable regime, measure the gravitino mass, measure the slepton mass, measure the width of the slepton to a lepton and a gravitino. We, of course, all know the Planck's constant. And if this picture is correct of a visible sector coupled to a hidden sector where you adjusted dynamics to make sure that the cosmological constant is near zero, then you would have had a relationship that you could verify experimentally, and you would have had access to some of these structural questions. Of course, the universe apparently, of course, we can cross our fingers for 14 TeV LHC, has not provided us with a metastable charge particle. So we're not talking in this meeting about building giant stopper detectors to capture sleptons and watch them decay. But we could have been. In fact, we could be even talking about more complicated dynamics. I did some work with Cliff Chung and Yasunori Nomura about more complicated dynamics in the hidden sector, where there could be multiple sources of supersymmetry breaking, and the supersymmetry breaking that we feel is actually a subdominant source that provides us with soft masses, but the dynamics that's responsible for tuning the cosmological constant is sequestered from us. In that case, you have multiple Goldstone fermions from this breaking, multiple Goldsteini, and we would be measuring two decays, one to the pseudo-Goldsteino from this sector that talks to us, one to the Gravitino that's a linear combination of the Goldsteini from these sectors, and we could even learn more dynamics. We could have measured this pseudo-Goldsteino mass in this crazy factor of two in the Goldsteino mass to Gravitino mass relation. That's actually a property of anti-de Sitter space supersymmetry, and the decay rates to Goldsteini and Gravitinos, that actually tells us about the amount of supersymmetry breaking dynamics in one sector versus the other. I mean, there was these nice, interesting structural questions that we could have had access to. And ultimately, you know, 100 years from now, we'd love to be able to come back to some of these structural questions. And so that's where I start in thinking about supersymmetry. And then, of course, getting whacked in the face with the fact that there's no superpartners, at least no superpartners under the lamppost. Now, our lamp is going to grow. We have 7 TeV, 8 TeV lampposts right now. We're going to have 13 TeV, 14 TeV lampposts later. And I think it's clear that in supersymmetry, the task is to find evidence for superpartners. And there's different directions one could go. One could say, oh, you know, physics is just a little bit heavy, in which case you go to higher energy and you can explore higher mass scales. And something that would be fun to discuss in discussion is, are there other blind spots for supersymmetry, even if the mass scales are in the range where we naively would think they're bounds? Are there ways via squeeze spectra, R parity violation, third generation rich final states, other blind spots that might hide supersymmetry? This line item here of third generation rich, this is something that was discussed a lot of year ago, but actually in this current batch of results here shown for CMS, but shown a little bit more dramatically in this plot from Atlas, actually the call from the theory community to say, you know, we need to make sure we have full coverage of third generation searches, it has been implemented. And some of the most stringent bounds on third generation rich signatures, in this case, gluino decays to two tops and a neutralino, such that pair production of gluinos gives you a four top final state, we have amazingly stringent bounds compared to what I might naively have thought that you could do with LHC8. You know, gluino masses being tested up to, you know, 1.2 TeV, depending on exactly what the neutralino mass is. Now, the way that we respond to this situation, that's what we're talking about, and that's what I hope we will discuss. And one way to respond is just to have this angst about, oh God, supersymmetry, not seeing anything, it's all going down the toilet. And the other one is to look for sources of optimism or pessimism that can tell you the direction forward. So one source of optimism, which Xerxes mentioned, was that, come on, supersymmetry, naturalness, these things want to go together. Supersymmetry wants to be natural. It wants to give us a solution to the hierarchy problem. We should be using that as motivation for really digging into the structure of supersymmetry. And I think a lot of you in this audience are quite familiar with natural supersymmetry, an idea from the mid-90s that has now been revived under this name of splitting the dynamics such that the superpartners relevant for controlling quadratic divergences in the Higgs sector, these guys are light, and the ones that are kind of not really that relevant, you can decouple. And what's exciting about this scenario, okay, despite the fact that recent top-rich searches have meant that in V1 or V2 or V3 of my papers on natural SUSY, you got to keep pushing the spectrum a little bit higher, what's exciting about this is that if you really think that there's a hierarchy between third generation physics and first two generation physics, then you know that there's an opportunity for connections between flavor and SUSY. That this splitting means that there's something that you're going to see in flavor physics, and of course, we hope that this spectrum is going to give us something that we can see at the LHC, let's say, right around the corner. And just to give you a concrete example of this connection between flavor and supersymmetry, I did work with Nathaniel Craig and Matthew McCullough of trying to connect supersymmetry breaking with flavor in a way that could give you some interesting predictions. And this is just an example. I could give you any other number of models involving natural SUSY, but this one I think speaks to why this flavor SUSY connection could be interesting. In the standard model, we have this hierarchy among the quarks, with the third generation being heavy. And if you thought that there was a flavor symmetry that really rotated all the generations amongst each other, some gauge symmetry, then the large breaking of that gauge symmetry via the third generation tells you that if there was some broken SU3 flavor gauge group, then the gauge bosons corresponding to that third generation, the ones that live in the coset space SU3 mod SU2, those guys are heavy. And because SU3 has Karton rank 2, there's basically two guys, the kind of third generation-esque gauge bosons, and then the other two. And then if you use these gauge bosons to mediate supersymmetry breaking, you get an interesting spectrum. The guys that talk to the third generation, they're heaviest. They're least able to communicate supersymmetry breaking, so the third generation is light. These guys are a little bit lighter. They're better able to communicate SUSY breaking, so the first two generations are heavier. And moreover, because of this fun fact of it being a Karton rank 2 group, you only have two splittings, and so you have nice degenerate first two generations, good for flavor constraints, third generation light. This is the desired natural superpartner hierarchy. But there's still a prediction. You can't just do this for free. You really are introducing new flavor structure in terms of this hierarchy. And at minimum, you expect some flavor signals, for example, from B-meson mixing. So if this picture of natural SUSY is correct, we're going to see light Higgs-Zenos, of course. We're going to see third generation rich physics. The Gluino, maybe it's a little bit heavier than a TEV. And we'll have this opportunity to really explore favor physics. So this is an example that I think can give us optimism about the future of supersymmetric measurements. But then there's the flip side, and then there's the reason for pessimism, which is that we've seen a standard model-ish Higgs at 126 GeV. And different people have had different responses to this. I think no one doubts about the accuracy of the Higgs being where it is. I think no one doubts that it's at least standard model-ish, and we hope that there's some deviation. But if you kind of step back and think about at least minimal supersymmetric scenarios, this Higgs at 126 is telling us something very important. It's telling us where the superpartners want to be. And if you believe that the MSSM is a good approximation to supersymmetric spectra, then at least we know where to look for stops. If we're in a relatively large tan beta regime, depending on whether we're in minimal or maximal mixing, we're either going to have stops between 2 TeV or 10 TeV. And so at least we know where to look for it. But 2 TeV, OK, maybe that's doable at LHC 14. 10 TeV, pair production, OK, I guess that's out. But
so what is the zero of your position?
I'm taking this from a paper on mini split SUSY. You know, we can talk more about this particular plot about what scale.
You get much lower, right?
Well, so am I reading this right? Anyway, we can talk about this. I would say at a zeroth order, ignoring the specific number. So I agree that it's important to get a specific value of the numbers in specific scenarios, but I would say that if you're looking at this more broad brush. That this, at least for me, and this is the way that I interpret it, and I'm glad that I'm listening strong opinions from you. The way that I interpret this, okay, it's a strong fact. That this at least gives me circumstantial evidence for a mini desert, in the sense that, of course, there could be other dynamics that's allowing the Higgs to be heavy, something like the NMSSM, lambda SUSY, non-decoupling D terms. You could have a splittish spectrum where some of these fermions are a little bit heavy, but gauge NOs could be lighter. But in some sense, the problem or the thing that I was forced to confront when coming up with an opinion on supersymmetry is how to respond to the possibility that some of the particles that I hoped had been light from a natural SUSY point of view, there might be some evidence that they're heavy. And how heavy is an interesting question. Absolutely. No. In fact, if we go to these searches here, there's any number of different ways where, of course, this search. In fact, there's two different colors of these bars, which are really point out the crucial thing that we can't just use the edge of these bars where we say LSPs are at zero, GeV. That we have to account for the specific details of these searches, and that's why I would say there's reason for optimism, saying this is not giving us full coverage, and that there is room for supersymmetry to persist, but. The flip side version of that is that, if, for example, I am someone who believes that A terms are small, but I believe in the MSSM, then I'm forced into thinking about how do searches proceed? How do questions at the frontier, how do they proceed in this possibility of things being a little bit decoupled?
You know, I think the confusion is that MC of here is equivalent
to parameter of C. Yeah. Oh, sorry. As opposed to, okay, great. So this is the way that I approach this this situation. One is that Susie's right around the corner, in which case the highest priority obviously is finding evidence for super partners, and we know exactly what steps to take for that. Okay, we're already upgrading the LHC to 1314 TeV. We get a nice improvement in the reach for super partners. The community, both the theory and the experimental community, are going to have to confront challenging kinematics and challenging final states, things like squeeze spectra, things like R parity violation, where the amount of missing energy is small or absent, and something that I would like to just stick my neck out and say, and high luminosity LHC, which Europe has already committed to, and I hope that the US commits to, because there are searches for which it really matters having high luminosity. You often say, oh, luminosity, you want more than you want luminosity, and that's generally true. But if you're in a situation where you have plenty of signal, you're not in a situation where there's no signal, you're buried under background, then what high luminosity can allow you to do is apply more and more and more stringent cuts in order to tease that signal out of the background. And an example that that Zoltán Ligeti was kind enough to point me in the direction of, for example, trilepton searches for electroweak ENO pairs. This is a situation where at 300 inverse femtobarns, you know, the 5 sigma discovery reach puts you in the kind of 300, 400, 500 GeV mass range for the heavier of the states. And then their cascade down to the lighter state is what you're looking for. And if you have 3,000 inverse femtobarns, I mean, it even goes off of the plot here, that you're able to cut harder, dig that signal out from the background, and go to a more extreme kinematic regime. By the way, the same phenomena is seen when you're looking for Higgs to BB bar. What was realized in the jet substructure community is that you want to see associated production of Higgs and Z. You can cut hard, put yourself in a boosted regime, get yourself away from the background by going to a little more extreme kinematics and dig out this Higgs to BB bar signal. The same kind of thing is happening here. You can get yourself away from the electroweak backgrounds by cutting hard, and you're allowed to cut hard if you have high luminosity. So I hope other people have other motivations for high luminosity LHC, but this to me seems like a no-brainer. The more interesting question, and the one to have an opinion, is what to do if Susie's around the next corner. And this is more in this decoupling regime. And what box do we check? Hopefully we can check more than one box for the type of the strategy that we would pursue if we don't uncover Susie through what I think is the straightforward course of action. Of course, one thing you can do is a search for super partners continuing on. And if you want to see colored super partners, you know, we can decide what exact machine one would do, build a 100 TeV proton-proton machine perhaps, long-term investment in advanced accelerator technology to really push the energy frontier. That doesn't seem to be as much of the discussion in SNOMAS as far as I can tell. And so the last part of this talk is to give you what I think are sometimes less direct probes of supersymmetry, but ones which I think we can assign a priority to in the sense of they're ubiquitous in supersymmetric scenarios and therefore are worthy targets that we should shoot for. And again, I was asked to have an opinion. I'm going to give you 3 things that I think are high priority, and you should have one as well. We've heard some already. And think about, if we're not successful in this round, what is the next direction or strategies to go? I hope we're successful in this venture, but I do want to be aware that there are less direct probes of supersymmetry that we might want to test. Okay, so this is my wish list for the frontiers. I call this 3 oases in the mini desert. If fermions are quasi-decoupled, and focusing on the ubiquitous elements of supersymmetric models that I think are accessible in near-term frontier experiments, these are the things that I want to see. And I'll try to explain to you why I want to see them and what I hope we can understand of what targets we want to have. So 2 Higgs doublet plus singlet sectors. These are ubiquitous, obviously, in supersymmetric scenarios. High-scale symmetry violation. I'll shine a light on CP here. And then thermorelic neutralino dark matter, kind of an obvious choice, but you'll see where I'm going with this. And in each of these cases, I have questions for the audience because I'm not full experts on any of these areas, and I want to have your input about whether these are worth doing, how to do them, where our blind spots are in these scenarios. So let me go one by one in my remaining however many minutes. Perfect. Two minutes per. Okay, so first, two Higgs doublet and singlet sectors. So apologies to the wrong Higgs or inert Higgs literature, but come on, supersymmetry wants two Higgs doublets. Wants two Higgs doublets, perhaps singlets in the context of the NMSSM. And the scenario that I'm envisioning in my mind is that fermions really are quasi-decoupled, but for some reason, which I haven't yet figured out, the Higgs sector, the Higgs scalars and singlets are still at the weak scale. And the questions that arise in this scenario, if this were really realized in nature, we heard a little bit about this from Nathaniel Craig, is the interplay between direct searches for extended Higgs states and indirect tests through the properties of the Higgs. And so I think Howie mentioned the infamous wedge appearing in the tan beta MA plane. This is coming from a paper where they're taking the kind of extreme decoupling regime of the MSSM and asking what searches could be sensitive in these various regimes. Some of these, though it's not shown in this plot, some of this at kind of low values of MA are constrained by precision Higgs coupling measurements. But I don't know how fast you can go and whether you can actually push into this wedge. And so one question that I'd like to have firmer in my brain is really this relationship between direct and indirect tests for extended Higgs states. And then from the point of view of thinking about a lepton collider, how fast does one hit the decoupling regime? That is, how heavy do I have to push these extra scalar states before precision Higgs measurements just don't have any reach? And then for the model builders, a question about how you would actually get yourself into the scenario. How can you be consistent with current Higgs bounds, meaning that you need to be in an alignment regime without decoupling the states? And then is the situation of having heavy fermions but light Higgs states, is that actually renormalization group stable? But this is a situation where we have complementary tests on different type of experiments, and we should exploit this since this is such a ubiquitous feature in supersymmetric models. So the next one is symmetry violation terms, and particularly CP. So there's any number of justifications for why various symmetries of the standard model should be violated. So here is a bunch of terms in the superpotential. They all have corresponding terms in the soft masses. And one logical possibility is that fermions are quasi-decoupled. They're a little bit heavy. But there's still some remnant information because of symmetry violation, be it baryon number, lepton, lepton flavor, quark flavor, CP. As a model builder, the easiest one to point to is electric dipole moments coming from the CP problem. And kind of turning on its head, the model building challenge of trying to make Gaugino masses and Higgsino masses aligned can now be turned into an opportunity where I can say, here's a target for electric dipole moment searches, where, as is known from the old Split-Suzy literature, two-loop effects generate, for example, in this case, neutron EDMs that are within the target of anticipated programs. And so this is a case where the words, fermions are quasi-decoupled, but other states might still be around, gives you a target for what value of the electric dipole moments you should want to see. What I would like to know from this audience is, are there motivated targets for these other types of violation? I think all of us agree that intensity frontier experiments should just push as far as they can go in lambda. Go to as short distances as you can indirectly, but it'd be nice in my brain to have a target for the types of violation that I might see. I don't know of one. Rather, it's the other way around, that you have to model build to make sure that flavor's not a problem, and I don't have a good sense of what the right targets are for these other types of violations, whereas in my brain I do have a good sense of the targets for CP, so I'd like your feedback on that. And then the final one is thermorelic neutralino dark matter. We heard about this already a little bit this morning, taking the MSSM, perhaps tacking on a singlet. And a logical possibility, one that seems quite reasonable to me, is that yes, fermions are a little bit decoupled, but this amazing fact of the Wimp miracle is indeed realized in nature, and it's realized for the neutralinos. Of course, supersymmetry gives you any number of other candidates for dark matter. We have non-thermal production of dark matter. Dark matter could be underabundant and compensated by axions. But just in terms of a target for searching, thermorelic neutralino dark matter is a useful target. And we heard a little bit about this morning, but I'd like this statement to be firmed up. We heard about blind spots in direct detection, where if you have a particular linear combination of Beno-Winu-Higgsino, that there just happens to be cases where direct detection cross-sections are small. And what are the ways of covering that? My sense is that the community knows this answer about the extent to which indirect detection can cover these holes, but I just haven't had a clean statement of it. And then also for the people who have been working on model-independent searches for dark matter at colliders, I'd like to know, if I gave you 3,000 inverse femtobarns of LHC-14 data, can you tell me what the ultimate reach is for mono-anything searches? Assuming that you have this decoupled fermion regime. I suspect that there are people in the audience that know this. This would help me understand what the target for colliders would be for neutralino dark matter. And the specific cases that I have in mind, the ones that I think are most reasonable dark matter scenarios given this quasi-decoupled regime, are the cases of nearly pure Higgsino and nearly pure Wino, with masses given respectively of 1 TeV and 2.7 TeV. These, in my mind, are very plausible thermal relics. And I'd like to understand whether the current suite of experiments that we're thinking, direct detection, indirect detection, collider experiments, are they sensitive to these particular cases? For direct detection, it's known that this is hard, that in the really pure regime, you have absence of both Z couplings and Higgs couplings, and the Lupin disk couplings is also accidentally small, the level of 10 to the minus 47 centimeters squared. So direct detection may not be the right strategy here, but I'd love to be proven wrong. For indirect detection, I know that for non-thermal Winos, there's strong bounce from Fermi and Hess, and I think there are people in this audience who knows what the prospects are for thermal Winos and Higgsinos, in particular the Cherenkov telescope array, or what we heard earlier this morning from neutrino telescopes. Do these guys really definitively cover that parameter space? And finally, in thinking about a futuristic collider, if indeed, let's say, dark matter is a 2.7 TeV Wino, do we even have a hope, even if there's tiny neutralino chargino mass splittings, for any kind of experiment that might be able to probe this? Or even better, can you tell me that current experiments could actually do this? Okay, strong opinion, and I would like to hear that afterwards, and I will point at you first for telling me why this already is off the table. Okay, so let me just kind of come back full circle and just summarize what I've said and then give you your charge. So where I came from approaching snowmass as someone completely from the outside being asked to give a provocative talk on supersymmetry was to start big and say, ideally, superpartners could be used as probes to answer structural questions. But then being forced to come back down to Earth looking at recent LHC data that, well, we're not apparently in that ideal world, though we have prospects coming up when the LHC turns back on. But if I really look at that Higgs at 126 and I'm really thinking MSSM, maybe we need to confront the idea of a mini-desert. So my higher priority targets, given ubiquitous elements of SUSY that still persist in that quasi-decoupling regime, two Higgs doublet plus singlet sectors, symmetry-violating terms, thermorelic neutralino dark matter, and then other things that I've highlighted, the importance of a high luminosity LHC, especially for background limited processes. And then I would like at some point to have a discussion about whether ambitious next generation energy frontier machines can actually answer the questions that we want to have. Now your charge is to disagree with me or tell me that I'm wrong, that I'm misguided, or reinforce any of this, and hopefully we'll have a vigorous discussion for the next 45 minutes on these topics. Thank you very much.